Audio warbles.
Bodies and beings. Audio Warbles is the public-facing part of Murmurations, a Living Words and Normal Festival of the Brain knowledge exchange with University of the Creative Arts. Murmurations is a project in 2025 with neurodivergent fine art students and staff of UCA and Living Words founder Susanna Howard. We went into the woods to explore patterns in creativity, neurodivergence and the natural world.
Hello, so welcome to this. This is part of a project called Murmurations, Patterns in Creativity, Neurodiversity and the Natural World. It's produced in partnership with Living Words and it's part of a knowledge exchange project for University of the Creative Arts and will form part of our public programming. I'm Arlie Bean and I'm the gallery curator here at UCA, and I'm joined today by Samantha Friedman, who is a lecturer in applied psychology at University of Edinburgh, and Poppy Jackson, who is an artist based in Norwich focusing on performance art. So I'm going to get everyone to just start by introducing themselves and sharing a little bit about their practice and their research interests. So maybe if we can hear from you first, Sam.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Sam Friedman, as you said. I work within an education school at the University of Edinburgh, but my PhD was in developmental psychology. And I trained as a teacher before that. So I kind of sit in between the worlds of education and psychology and really thinking about how we can apply what we know from psychology to making school experiences better. Where my research really falls is, again, at kind of an intersection point between studying autism and other forms of neurodivergence and studying nature and how nature can support well-being. So I bring those two things together and look at how autistic people experience nature and other forms of, or other neurominorities as well. And also looking at things like nature-based learning and how we could use that to improve school experiences for neurodivergent young people, because we know that neurodivergent young people are often very much harmed by schools and have very poor experiences. So that's kind of where my research sits, but some of my stuff is just on autism and neurodiversity and some of it is just on nature. So I kind of dabble all over the place.
Great, thank you. And Poppy, can we hear a little bit about what you do?
Yes, so like you said, I'm mainly based in performance art, live art. I work with the body, my body as a material. This has led me to work site-specifically often. I found that working in galleries could be quite restrictive, especially with the audience you can reach. And so, I've just been led to working in liminal or wild spaces now that are around the place in which I live. And I guess I'm at the moment in being a mother, it's really instilled in me to, I guess, try as much as I can to impart the value that my experience and like my artistic value brings to my community, which is sometimes challenging because my work often involves nudity or body fluids and things that are taboo. So that's, it feels like a tricky kind of territory I'm working with at the moment, kind of making that as accessible as possible, but being aware of the taboo status of those things. So,
For people who are listening who perhaps don't know much about performance art, and particularly in the context of this discussion where we're really trying to hone in on neurodiversity and nature, can you talk a little bit just about kind of what performance art is in terms of how you work with your body or somatic practice or sensory experience, just to give us a little sense of kind of, yeah, what performance is, if we don't know.
Performance is so hard to define, and that's why I love it. The best quote I heard about performance art was that it was a limitless medium, and that's why I love it so much. You don't need any specific training, any specific physical skills, any specific education to be a performance artist. You literally just need a body, and in that way, every single person can relate to it. For me personally, it sprang out of just a genuine fascination by my own body, my own bodily processes, particularly menstruation. And then I've had my two children, so pregnancy and breastfeeding. So a real, personal deep dive into what those processes were, and a really exploratory, innocent way, just with a lot of wonder. And then for me, it's come like a crossroads between when I show that work, the attitudes that might receive that work societally would often come from a completely polar opposite perspective, maybe with fear or disgust, just be repelled by especially menstrual blood. So I found my work as a way to try to, meld those things together, be aware of both perspectives, and use my body as a research ground as well as a medium to answer any of those questions, but just to explore them.
Great, thanks. And I'm going to try and get out of the habit of asking too many questions, because what I'm really interested in this session is to really hear you both in conversation and where these overlaps between your research might be. But perhaps just to get us started, Sam, I don't know if you have any responses to that in terms of your experience working with neurodiverse people and how the body might be present in that.
Yeah, hugely, I think. So in some of the work that I've done, I have asked autistic adults primarily they're autistic adults, but as we know, many autistic people have co-occurring identities that fall within the realm of neurodiversity. So a lot of autistic people also identify as having ADHD or being dyslexic or, you know, any number of things there. So I am talking about autistic adults and not intending to use the word autism or autistic as a synonym for neurodivergent, because obviously those aren't the same things. But, you know, there's a kind of multitude of identities wrapped up there. So when I've done this work with autistic adults and asking about their experiences in nature, and particularly asking things about connection to nature and the kind of relationship that they feel with nature or the sensory experiences they have, there's a huge piece of talking about their own kind of embodied experience of this. And the way, I think when you talk about this kind of in the general population, connection to nature becomes this very sanitized binary. You're either connected or not. Nature is something that's out there. And, you know, we're in here and we have to go out and seek it out. And it becomes very simplified. But what I found is in having these conversations and in asking autistic people what they think about connection to nature, it becomes so much messier and it becomes so much more entangled around the fact that they are inextricably linked with nature. So it's not this thing that you can connect or disconnect from. For some people, totally saw it the same way as, you know, that kind of binary. But also describing feelings of, there's one participant in a study that I did who described feeling the vibrations of the earth. And they said, I actually feel bad for neurotypical people who don't experience that, because they were describing their connection to nature as being so deep and so powerful just because of like their body, the way that they were made, and that facilitated a closer connection, which I think is really cool. So that piece comes up. We've done some recent work with Dr. Karen McLennan at the University of Bath and Elle Smith, who is a master's student of Karen's. And we were asking about sensory experiences in nature, again, with autistic adults. And what we really found there is, I think we were expecting responses like really strictly around sensory experiences, right? So like I found that to be, you know, an overwhelming sound or a pleasant feel, like a, you know, feeling touch. But what we found actually is that people were describing their sensory experiences in a way that was so interconnected with their description of their relationship with nature. So it was very much this idea of, you know, I feel calm in nature, and so then this sensory experience is pleasing. But then if this other, you know, like if humans come in, that shatters my connection with nature. So this really entangledness, I guess is the word, between sensory experiences and how they related to nature. So yeah, very long rambling way of saying, I think it is all tied together. I don't think it's easy to kind of separate out kind of embodied experience from experiences in nature or relationships with nature.
Yeah, I loved so much the phrase in your paper that Beanside did about nature and autistic adults and the wonder they feel about nature, and that like the quote that I always go back to is Jackson Pollock saying, in response to the question, do you work from nature? And he said, I am nature. And that was so apparent in that paper, and it not being something that is separate and beyond. There was like no like clear binary, and yeah, it was really interesting that there was quotes in there that I guess spoke about the wonder of that and the positivity of that, but then also that there was one that said it makes me sad. Yeah, so I think we always think of like this connection to nature as being something positive and, you know, like happy and sunny and everything, but actually it's way more complicated than that. And just, yeah, it's just full of really, really deep feelings that are positive, negative. I mean, it's so complex where I am, because I am in a really idyllic, beautiful, rural space. And it's absolutely stunning. But when I, you know, bring people here who've come from London, they're often just in awe and just feel like they can breathe, and it's just a lovely feeling. But recently I brought somebody on the lane that I live down, and they're like, wow, this is so beautiful, and look at the woods and the trees and the nature and everything. And they're like, oh, what's that? And I was like, oh, that's the chicken factory. And you know, that's all mingled in, you know, it's so complicated. And obviously you know, would you say that the pig farm is nature? And then there's stories there of, you know, the maternal and the mother pig rolling over onto her own piglets and them not surviving. And it's so much more complex than just the sanitized way, I think, that the word nature has become for us in society. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think until I did, I mean, this is like embarrassing to admit, but a lot of the work that I was doing before I did that study that informed the paper that you're talking about there, a lot of the work that I was doing was really viewing nature as this fantastic, wonderful, positive thing that if we can engage people with nature, they will experience benefits, right? If we can get autistic children out into nature, they will have a better time. And it wasn't until there was kind of some criticality that I was starting to introduce before then. But when I did that study, that survey study of autistic adults, and people were responding and saying, you know, nature is these things, it is the idyllic, you know, woodlands, the things that you were just describing. And it's also, like, I think someone particularly said, it's malaria, it's earthquakes, you know, it's COVID, it's pig factories and chicken farms and, you know, whatever. It's that full range of things. And it was the first time that I was kind of like, oh yeah, like we do have to consider that full range, because if we're only thinking about the positives and the benefits, and then someone tells us, you know, well, I found that really upsetting, or I didn't have a nice time, or I found the sensory experience distressing. If we've set it up so that actually they should have had a good time, like, you know, we're completely invalidating an experience. And, you know, Poppy, I don't know kind of if you've had this, if you've seen this with people kind of experiencing or interacting with your art, But, you know, like we think of people having, you know, only positive views of these things, but actually there are some people who, for whom like that space will never be a happy space. It will never be an accessible space, whatever, like those types of things. So I think that complexity is really important. And I think it has to be acknowledged so that that full range of experiences is validated. And not to completely jump, but I was interested, Poppy, when you were describing, you said a lot of your work was site specific, and you know, I can imagine the settings that you're, and I've looked at some of the photos of, or I think it was a video of some of the work that you've done. It is, you know, very idyllic woodlands and all of this stuff. And I was curious how that sense of place, you know, what are you thinking when you're kind of choosing these sites? Is it, yeah, I guess just kind of, I was interested in the meaning behind it, or the reasons that you choose these sites. Is it because they're beautiful? Is it because you're hoping to evoke this kind of conflicting feeling in people of beauty next to less, you know, kind of conventional beauty, or yeah, anything like that?
Sure. Yeah. It's so complicated as well as a female body. The symposium organized in upstate New York was based around why is the female body seen as more intrinsically tied to nature than the male body? And how do we disrupt that when we show performance art like that, obviously our bodies are in as female bodies in a natural environment, whatever natural means. like, how do we untangle that? And it's just so complicated. But I mean, my work is so intuitive, and I love how using my body as medium completely tangles my life with my work. So often I would choose a site because I'm just drawn to it, and I like that there is no logical reasoning for that. It's like, I'm really drawn to this place. It speaks to me. There's something about it, the energy within it, just, I can feel an intensity there, and it's somehow speaking to me. And I think that's such a valid reason to work in a place that, you know, I don't want to unpack too much, like what that might be on an intellectual level. Because to me, that is a completely valid reason in of itself. The reason I started to sit on the apex of buildings, on the roofs, was because, I'd often see birds sitting in that place. I was like, wow, that's such a power place. Like, they're sitting there because they can see everything, but it just felt so charged, you know, that like both of those lines leading to that point, like that's a real power place. And I loved as well the fact that, you know, obviously because of those birds sitting there, they would shit on that point. And then there's this whole thing about, you know, bird shit being lucky, and where does that come from? And that tie to nature. And then, you know, there's a bit of disgust in that as well, but it's just a natural thing. And the, you know, that comes from the bird. And and also, again, it's really hard sometimes to find a location to perform in, because it's, you know, it's something that there's a lot of, I guess, like there's fears and, like I said, taboos around just working with the naked body. And I like to leave my process completely open to nudity or body fluids or whatever it might be. So if I'm working in a site, I want to not be restricted as much as possible. And obviously, working in places like the Freud Museum, there was a hell of a lot of rules and restrictions, I like using them as a material to kind of find out about the place rather than seeing them as a restriction. But if I'm choosing a place, then it's great to be as, I guess, like free as possible. So that often comes down to, you know, just negotiations and a person that you might feel able to speak to more freely about what I want to do. And that's so complicated. Obviously, funding is a huge issue as well. But yeah, I guess like all of that feeds into the work, and it might not be within the frame of the work that the audience will necessarily see, but I feel like they can sense that and pick up on it. And, you know, the support of maybe site owners that they're curious about performance art, and, you know, all of that ties into it. So it's just, yeah, very, very complicated.
And yeah, you mentioned, sorry, you mentioned the birds there, Poppy, and I'm aware that quite often you end up forming these collaborations, I would say, with the more than human out there. I wondered if you could both reflect a little bit on that from both of your different perspectives.
Yeah, Poppy, do you want to go first?
No, after you.
Yeah, you know, I think from my perspective, again, going back to this kind of more clinical or sanitized version of looking at nature and connection to nature, the more than human is typically seen as less. And I really liked, Poppy, when you're talking about power, I was gonna kind of pick up on that or ask you a bit about that, because there is really something when we're talking about humans and nature and like the interconnectedness or the lack thereof. There really is something about power there. And there is something, I think, when we're talking about the more than human, is humans, at least in a lot of the literature on nature and connection to nature, humans are seen as the like the dominant, you know, the holder of power, the superior thing, the thing that takes priority, all of that. And the more than human is seen as less important, or seen as something that humans can manipulate, or that humans can do something to, but they're not seen as equals to that. And so there's some really interesting work specifically thinking about like nature-based learning. You know, there is a lot of work looking at outdoor learning and like what happens if we literally just take lessons and do them outside. But there is an increasingly critical view as well of like what happens when we learn with and from the more than human rather than learning from a human teacher. Or what if we open up curriculum to these more emergent, you know, things that might arise rather than something that a human has decided is important. So I think, you know, the more than human is starting to be considered in these more critical views, but typically it really is seen as, you know, kind of separate from humans and inferior to humans.
So can I ask, like, how practically, like, would you go about that? I mean, that all just sounds so exciting, and like, yeah, I don't know, I'm just like so curious, like, how practically could you do that?
I think it's really difficult. I think it's a lot easier said than done, and I think it requires, so if we think about the constraints that teachers are working within, if you're thinking about a kind of traditional schooling model, there are very few ways to truly embrace, it's kind of called like wild pedagogies is what it's often referred to as. And it's really difficult within the constraints of a typical school to embrace that, to follow, you know, that kind of emergent curriculum, because there is a set curriculum that you have to tick all the boxes for, right? So, you know, ideally I would love to say that there's some, you know, we could take students out for a walk and then we could really allow them the space and the capacity and teach them how to attune to the more than human and learn from those things. But it's just not the way our systems are set up. So I think the way that I see this working well is in alternative settings primarily. So settings that are entirely nature-based or that don't have to necessarily conform to a really rigid curriculum. Settings, I mean, it's unfortunate, but they're often for young people who can't access a traditional schooling program for whatever reason. And so they're kind of sent to these like last resort type of programs where it's almost like they're being written off. But it's actually there that there's more autonomy and freedom to be able to do this. And I think autonomy is a huge piece of that as well. So how do we learn from the more than human? Well, it's allowing people to autonomously explore, to leave behind any preconceived notions of what education should look like and what activities should look like and what normal behavior, that's very much in quotes. I realize this is an audio medium and not a visual one. you know, leave behind all of those really traditional normative conceptualizations of things and instead say, you know, what if we go out and be amongst a natural space, whatever natural looks like, whatever wild looks like, and kind of let go of our preconceived notions of what that should look like or what that should be. And this is all sounding very vague and abstract because I think it is. I think it has to be. But that's what feel. I think that's why it sits so uncomfortably in kind of traditional education contexts, because there's no room for that in education as it kind of currently stands.
If there was, though, that could be absolutely revolutionary.
Absolutely.
It's really exciting.
Yeah, like imagine that you could take a group of children outside and rather than teaching them that we need to like identify the leaves on the trees so that we know what the different trees are, like imagine you just had them sit with the tree and connect with the tree and do whatever feels right to learn about that tree from the tree.
Mm.
Like that sounds amazing. That sounds powerful. It sounds like, I mean, all three of us are like, yeah, that sounds great. That like, let's go do that. But actually, at the end of the day, when we're thinking about education, you have parents who are saying, well, what did my child learn today? And you have the school saying, well, what outcomes did they achieve? And so it just, again, like it doesn't fit within that system. But yeah, I agree, Poppy. Imagine if it did. Imagine if we did build a system where that was, there was space for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess like the work that I'm doing with Bristol Medical School is kind of trying to do that, but I've just been so inspired by what you were saying. I was like, imagine if we could take that one step further and it's not a performance artist teaching medical students, it's the wind in a street or, you know, like whatever. But yeah, I think we should try and build elements of that. It would be amazing. It would be so amazing. But I feel like it's such a privilege to work with the medical students because I learn so much from them about the body. But it does often feel quite sad because they are ranked countrywide. They're under so much pressure. There is this attitude of getting everything right. Everything has to be right, which of course I understand with what they're doing. But it's extremely difficult to get them to try and think outside of the box or in an illogical and creative or playful or, you know, like a way that fails on purpose. It's really, really difficult. And in the last few years, that's just one placement they do in the whole course and they can choose to do the placement or not. But because of the pressures they're under in the course, fewer and fewer students are choosing to take this placement, which is titled, you know, it's a well-being placement. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's difficult to, I mean, the students who have done the placement get a lot from it, but it's seen more as a time out of the course, I guess, rather than something that's going to benefit them and hopefully, you know, their careers in working with patients.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I think so much of this, whether it's these kind of more alternative education approaches that I was talking about or alternative education approaches you're talking about, they're seen as optional extras or deviations, detours, rather than fundamental pieces of, you know, rather than saying, actually, this is, you know, you need to understand how to work with the human body at a deeper level. So this is a requirement to think about it in a different way. It's seen as, well, this isn't, you know, essential to what you're doing. So if you want to go dabble, go dabble. You know what I mean? Like it seemed quite,
yeah.
It's a real shame because I think, you know, imagine what education systems, medical systems, things would be like if we could look at things a little bit more flexibly and look at things in a more critical, a way that doesn't sit so comfortably, that feels challenging.
Yeah, because I think it's something that, you know, it's not prioritized or it's not seen as something that has as much value. And it's actually, I mean, even art within that setting is seen as a bit of a DOS thing to some of the students. So it's just, yeah, I guess trying to, yeah, bring a different attitude towards it and a value to it that has been eroded away for such a long time.
I guess The hierarchies of neurodiversity and perceived neuronormality play into that kind of thing, right? And what we're talking about is creating a system or moving towards a system that actually centralizes the neurodivergent experience and is kind of putting that in the position of power and acknowledging that those forms of communication and sensing and experiencing are actually the things that perhaps we need more of.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree. And actually, going back to your question being about working or collaborating with the more than human, I guess that relates because it, for me, is I always approach that in a non-hierarchical way. Like, I would I've worked with, about 1,000 ladybirds in New York, and then a pigeon in an alleyway in Chicago that just happened to be there all day when I was getting ready for the performance, and was like, okay, this pigeon just really, it's not going anywhere. I was like, it wants to be in the performance. I'm gonna work with it. It's gonna be my collaborator. And it was like personally my favorite part of that work to experience. And obviously the elements, it's really tricky because the subject of autonomy is really important to me, and I want those materials to have their own autonomy. I think of it as when I work with paint and my body, I want to see where the paint goes on its own. I don't want to control it too much. I just want to tip it up and see where it goes and, see where the lines fall on me. But it's a really tricky one because, yes, but I directed that. That was my idea. So am I controlling it or am I not controlling it? It was my choice to work with those ladybirds. It was my choice to work with that pigeon, although it was there. So I'm always trying to build in as much autonomy as possible for those collaborations. It's such a tricky one. And I wrote about for Spiel Festival, an anthology, where there was a work which encased growing marrows and courgettes into molds of mainly fetus-like forms, so that when they would grow, they would obviously fill up this mold and they would be in the shape of a fetus. And I really found this work disturbing, and I was pregnant and then had a baby in the process of writing about it. And I think, artwork's such an amazing thing to have in the world. So it was such a difficult thing for me to feel so negatively about an artwork that I was writing about. But I wrote in there that when does play and exploration as an artist become management and control? And I think working with nature or the natural, you always have to just keep on thinking about that. Is it management and control or is it playfulness and an exploration? And those things can completely cross over together. It's something that needs to be continually evaluated.
So interesting. And I might be interpreting things very literally, which I tend to do. But when you're talking about this tension, I think, between autonomy, but your role and these types of things, it reminded me a lot around, so autonomy really is a big kind of piece of my work. It comes up a lot when we're talking about especially things like nature-based learning and taking autistic children outside at school, because we know that within a school building, children are often very much denied autonomy, denied dignity of risk, these kinds of things. But outside, there seems for some reason to be, and I have theories about why this might be, but there seems to be more opportunity, more potential to allow for autonomy. And something that really comes up a lot there, especially when we're talking about people who are perceived as vulnerable, whether or not I agree with that conceptualization, that is kind of, you know, how a child with additional support needs or special educational needs are seen. It's this idea of autonomy and structure coexisting. And that's kind of what I was hearing from you, Poppy, a little bit, is like the autonomy existing within the things that you were also controlling. And that actually you needed, in order to find out where the paint went, you needed to be the start of that, right? Like you had to have that role in order to for the next bit to happen. And I think that often I see, I talk about, you know, we need to promote autonomy for children outside, especially autistic children. And teachers will say things, you know, or just general population will say things like, well, you know, we can't allow for autonomy because of safety, because we don't know what they'll do, because they might run away, because whatever. And it's like, right, okay, you're not going to set them up, like, you're not going to take a group of children and be like, see you later, go outside, that's fine, like, whatever. You would set boundaries, right? And you would hopefully co-create those boundaries. So we're not going to go beyond the river. We're not going to go beyond the trees over there. Like, this is our space. So it really is that autonomy within structure. So without the structure, and especially when we're talking about autistic young people or autistic people generally, and this is a big generalization, but a lot of autistic people really prefer to have some level of structure and, you know, expectations and boundaries to know what to work within. So actually, just like you have to throw the paint up in order for it to lie a certain way, you have to set that structure up first in order to allow for autonomy when we're doing things like learning outside. And yes, that could happen inside. But for some reason, again, I have my theories, but like it's much easier to facilitate this outside than it is inside, I think, at least in schools.
Yeah, because I did work with forest schools and I've taken my kids to forest school, and I was so amazed and happy to see that that was a setting that they had, like, they literally had hammers, real hammers and nails, not toy ones, tin cans, materials they could potentially hurt themselves with, real fires, like all sorts of amazing things, like very narrow wobbly planks over big ditches of water. It was so exciting to them, and they learned so much about their own bodies and each other and the environment. And yeah, I can't imagine that level of risk happening at any of the indoor kind of clubs and things I've taken them to.
Yeah, and like it could, if we were a bit more flexible, a bit more willing, like it could happen, right? But it doesn't. And you know, it's you're exactly right. At things like forest school, you know, I've worked with really young children with knives, because actually there's nothing inherently dangerous about that if we teach how we use a knife properly, right? That's that structure. Again, like we're not just going to hand a two-year-old a knife and be like, all right, have fun, like see what you do with it. But there is an understanding there of like, I trust you, I respect you enough that you can understand how we can work with this. And then if you don't, like, we'll just take the knife away, right? Like, but it is that, you know, allowing for autonomy within, well-supported autonomy, I would say, when risk is assessed for and those things are thought about. Yeah, you mentioning there, so I'm again changing the subject, I hope that's okay. You mentioned there the like kind of indoor, or we were talking about the kind of contrast between indoor and outdoor. And I think you mentioned, Poppy, some work that you did inside, right? A performance piece that you did inside. I'm curious, because there's something that I feel very strongly, which is that nature is not an out there thing, especially if we're thinking of ourselves, human beings, as nature, but also just thinking about the many different ways we can experience nature, even from within a built setting. Does your perception of your body as a natural thing, or even your perception of how you interact with nature, however that's defined, does that change if you're in an outdoor space versus an indoor space, or it doesn't matter?
I hope that I can bring that inside the space, and yeah, that whole thing of like I am nature. I guess it's like having awe for what is human. That sentence brings to mind. It's like, yeah, bringing all of that inside, and does seem, I mean, it's hard to tell, because obviously if you're in, say, in like a white box gallery space, then sometimes it is a refreshing feeling because you're bringing everything and it's like it is this supposed blank slate that, you know, the work can just do its thing in complete autonomy, which of course is a total illusion. It's not at all. So yeah, I mean, it's a completely complex context within of itself, and it's a site within of itself, and I treat it completely like that. It's just very different, because when you're working outside, you don't know what's going to happen. And I guess it touches on what we were just talking about, but it's like the environment becomes such a part of that work, but you don't want to blank yourself out. Like, you want to bring yourself into that too. And yeah, it's just a fine line between feeling like, am I dictating or am I going with it? And we talk about the state of flow a lot in performance, or we talk about that, you know, in different ways, or use different phrases for it. But it's kind of that experience, I guess, of feeling maybe like at one with nature and everything makes sense and you feel part of it. And I guess that's an experience that I want to share with other people. And maybe that's part of the like drive to make performance art, particularly in public spaces where it's not just art audiences you might come across it. Because I think when you have a certain way of thinking, you do sometimes project that onto other people, or you grow up projecting that onto people and other people, and think like, oh, that everybody feels like that. And we tend to stick with, you know, people, or our families are thinking a similar way, and friend groups thinking a similar way. And a lot of the artists I know and spend a lot of time with are neurodiverse, and yeah, we experience the world maybe in some kind of similar way. So it's sometimes a shock to feel like, oh, maybe other people really don't feel like this at all and don't feel connected. And that, for me, feels like a big reason why the environment and community aren't seen as a connective resource, but something to exploit. And that feels awful. And yeah, I guess like working in this way, I feel like maybe part of the drive of that is to see if I can help people think in the way that is more connected.
And do you find a difference in terms of your process, your making process, and depending on what kind of space you're in? Just thinking about what Sam was saying about the internal spaces and external spaces. It's not quite what you said, but yeah, I wonder how that kind of affects your attention or your focus, and also just how you approach material and those kind of senses like texture and yeah.
I think it's maybe, I don't know, it's like a heightened way that it does seem sometimes artificial in a way, like, 'cause you're in this blank space that isn't really a blank space. Everything just becomes much more meaningful and symbolic, maybe. I guess in that way, it's like work has to be considered. Work has to be considered in a way that's like, right, this is, if it is a blank white gallery space, this is coming from me. Whereas if I'm in a site, I am responding to the site. So yeah, I mean, does feel like there's less risk involved, but because, you know, you're much more in control, you know what's going to happen, it's your work, there's way less, you know, things that could come into the performance that you haven't thought about or anticipated. So it does feel like, I guess, more being in control. I mean, the further I develop my practice, I feel like I'm maybe moving away from working in that way. But I do like the challenge that it brings. Yeah, it does feel like a totally different ball game. Like, it's totally a different way of making work. It is like bringing the outside in.
Yeah. You mentioned that unpredictability of the kind of external spaces. Is that something that makes it easier for you? Or is it harder? Is that something you prefer to have?
I feel like it can make me more connected to the audience, actually, because there's so much risk involved in what's going to unfold that I don't know. I always leave some kind of room for the unexpected to happen, and deliberately don't kind of rehearse to the T everything or plan everything. So it's got that space for things that might be unexpected to, you know, have their own room and become part of the work themselves. And I feel like having that energy in the work makes it more like as live as it could be. Like, it's something that is unfolding right there and then, and who knows like what might happen. And that feels really inclusive and hopefully generous to the audience, because they're seeing this thing that, you know, we don't really know, and it's risky, and I'm trusting them, and it's just, yeah, life. It's life. It's not, you know, it's, some of it is just totally not controlled at all. And that enables me to really feel like I am, like I said, like in that state of flow. And I guess it's like part of being in the adrenaline of the work as well, because unexpected things that do happen, you just have to be like, okay, I'm taking this on. There's no hiding. Like, it's just part of the work. And I find in general, like, audiences are really accepting of that, and they totally so far have come on board with that, and been supportive of that, and I guess protective of me within that space, which is a really lovely feeling. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you actually, Sam, about you were saying about how nature, our view of nature, has been defined as this kind of more like white male researcher, or, you know, like that kind of view of what nature is, which is something that's maybe not as threatening or frightening. And yeah, I loved how you were working with totally exploding that view of what nature is, and including like a way more diverse group of people within that, like, feeling about what nature is.
Yeah. I think a lot of the research on nature and experiences in nature, it comes from the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, some areas in mainland Europe. Like, it's quite homogenous, the view that's being perpetuated there. And I'm part of the issue there. Like, yes, I research a divergent group, in that I'm trying to represent marginalized voices. I don't want to say unheard, or, you know, because I think the voices are out there. It's maybe not listened to would be more accurate. But very much, I'm still white. I'm still from the UK, or I'm not from the UK, obviously. I'm from the US, but I'm living in the UK, right? Like, I am still perpetuating these very same positions. But I really take issue, especially with how we measure connection to nature as a concept. There's a lot of different tools out there that, you know, you can use in research to get someone's, or a group of people's, average score of connection to nature. And I was just saying this morning, my husband and I were on a walk with our dog, and there was some rubbish on the ground, and our dog tried to pick it up, and he almost, you know, he's a puppy, so he almost choked on it. It was a whole thing. And we were like, oh, that's so annoying that someone put that rubbish on the ground. But after we got him away from it, we didn't pick it up. It was like a poo bag. I didn't know what was on it, right? Like, we were like, okay, get away from that. And I said to him, I was like, well, we're complaining about people leaving this on the ground, but then we've just left this on the ground. And he's like, well, I don't know. Like, we're not near a bin. I don't know what's on that. Right. So we started talking about it, and I was like, see, this is the issue I have with some of the measures of connection to nature. So there's one for children. Now you've got me very fired up, puppy. There's one for children. That is one of the items is I pick up rubbish on the ground. I pick up trash. It's North American. And to me, that doesn't measure someone's connection to nature. That measures a cultural norm or a family norm, or maybe they're maybe like me, I was told, you know, don't pick up stuff off the ground if you don't have somewhere to put it and you don't know what, like, you don't know what's on it, whatever. Maybe you're immunosuppressed and you don't want to risk touching something that you don't like. There's so many different reasons why someone might not pick up rubbish off the ground that have nothing to do with how they feel their relationship with nature is or their perception of themselves in nature. Yes, it would be wonderful if we could all go around picking up rubbish and all of that, but that's not reality. So all of this to say, I really feel that a lot of the items, a lot of the ways that we seek to measure someone's connection to nature or label someone's connection to nature have nothing to do with divergent lived experiences, and instead have to do with these very stereotypical conceptualizations of what care for nature should look like, right? Like recycling, turning the lights off. Yes, these are good things to do. But why is that seen as more has higher value, a higher value behavior than Poppy's work and seeing your body, you know, innately intertwined with nature and trying to, like Poppy, you were describing, like hoping that other people get, you know, a kind of connection or something out of that. Why is that not seen as a high value behavior as far as promoting connection to nature and promoting pro-environmental behavior, but picking up rubbish off the ground is, right? Like, and of course, you know, I'm not likening those two things at all. Like, your work is very powerful. I'm not at all saying those are the same thing, but it's just to say that I think we put value and we put focus on these behaviors that have nothing to do with actually what we are measuring or what we are seeking to measure, and everything to do with cultural norms that come from a very select group.
So, and maybe are easy to understand and measure and aren't messy.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is why I'm primarily a qualitative researcher, is I really struggle with the how we dilute these concepts into things that we can answer on a 5-point Likert scale, you know, not at all like me, very like me type of things. How do we capture the complexity of that? How do we capture someone describing the vibrations they feel from the earth or the way that they feel connected to ancestry through nature? Or like, that doesn't distill down into a 10-item questionnaire very easily. So I really struggle with the way that those things are oversimplified and the way that that really prioritizes a certain experience.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, as well, though, like that word, like capture as well, it's like holding this thing that you can't really capture. And then like art and music, we talk about like lightning in a bottle, like there might be like an artwork or a piece of music that's like lightning in a bottle, like somebody captures that for a moment and shares it with other people and how amazing and magical that is. But because it is something ephemeral and out there and uncontained.
Yeah. Yeah, and I get the need for it, right? Like, I understand that if we want to make these larger, if we want to make suggestions at the population level, or we want to make improvements or whatever, we want to understand something at a larger level, I understand that we need to try to capture them. But then, do we need to understand this do you know what I mean? I guess that's also a question, is like, there's so many different just so many different ways that this can look. Do we need to have a consensus view? Or could actually Poppy's connection to nature be completely valid and my connection to nature be completely valid and Tom down the street's connection, you know what I mean? Like, can all of those things just exist and we don't have to be able to describe it in one certain way? Like, that makes research very difficult. So yeah. The answer's probably no, but yeah, I guess that's kind of where I fall on that.
That's why it's so exciting that you're gathering all of this research from different people and different ways of thinking, and, you know, that you're including the difficult, like, I find nature makes me sad. Like,
yeah,
it's incredible to have, you know, to gather all of that together somehow and have it there. Really unpack, like what is our own view of nature and how is that externalized by outside culture, and how we grow up with the imposed view of maybe like white middle-aged males' view of nature, and then we take that on board without even realizing. Yeah. Which actually I find in performance, it's like sometimes it becomes a way of like exorcising all of that from my own brain, because, you know, everybody's taken that on board, like nobody's immune to that, and like even if you're self-aware about as much as you can, there's, you know, we've still absorbed so much from our culture, and like we have no idea how much that affects us sometimes. So yeah.
Absolutely. And I think so much of the themes in your work are tied up in this as well, as far as like femininity, femaleness, gender, these types of things. There's another item on, I swear I haven't just like memorized all of the scales to critique them, but there's another item on a different scale that says, my ideal holiday is in a remote wilderness. There's a lot of reasons why that would be unsafe for people or just not very pleasant, but like specifically thinking about, okay, a lot of females, female presenting people, female identifying people might feel really unsafe in that setting, and actually being in a remote wilderness doesn't sound very nice. Similarly, you know, some male presenting people might as well, right? Like that's not completely, but there is something there around, it is a very, I would say, like cis white male perspective to think like the purest form of nature connection you can have is being in the middle of a remote wilderness by yourself with nothing to distract you. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I just take issue with those kind of views as well.
Yeah, sure. And like, have you found that like liminal spaces, kind of in-between spaces, I don't know, is there an attraction to that within your research, or those kind of wild spaces, or I don't know, as opposed to say like a designated park or some kind of natural area like that?
Do you know, interestingly, and it's probably the way that we kind of talk about nature in the setup of the study, we get a lot of people talking about stereotypically wild or natural spaces or human-made indoor internal spaces, and not very much of people talking about liminal spaces. But maybe that's something we should explore. We should look at that, because I think, yeah, it's people do think, I do think they consider things quite one way or the other, completely wild or completely the opposite, and very little about. So I'm trying to think. I don't think I've had any respondents talk about anywhere kind of in between that, which is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
it's given me a good idea there.
Okay. So yeah, just like within performance art, like being speaking about is, you know, like liminal spaces, those wild spaces. There's a lot of attraction to those kind of spaces in performance art, and I don't know. I wonder if it's like this kind of outsider thing. Like it's like feeling like a bit of a societal outsider, or if that, you know, when you're diversity wise being like an outsider and being attracted to those spaces, but I think it's a genuine, you know, like deep connection to those kind of spaces as well. Maybe the, I guess, like the wildness and chaos in those spaces, and maybe like as like an exploration performance-wise, that you feel more free to do your own thing in those kind of spaces rather than somewhere where the grass is mown like really nicely and there's like planted flowers and stuff. Yeah,
it's interesting. And I should clarify, when I'm talking wild spaces, there are some people who talk about kind of truly quote-unquote wild places of like untouched, you know, exploring more, you know, further. But I would say actually that's probably the minority. I think a lot of it is those kind of more managed, managed wild spaces, you might say, of like, not quite, like, I think there is a lot of the participants in my research say that things like parks, things that are incredibly managed, and there's a lot of human direction there, that those are less accessible spaces or less enjoyable spaces. But something kind of beyond that, kind of like managed wildness, I would say, is perhaps a bit more what they prefer to spend time in, for some people, but probably not the true wildness as much. But again, I think that, I think a lot of that comes down to how we, like myself as the, you know, researcher and the research team, how we talk about nature and how we ask these questions. I think it lends itself to those kinds of answers.
Sure.
That's something for me to be aware of.
Yeah, definitely. And there's probably not that many like truly wild spaces left, like in the UK. And I mean, America, there's some like really vast and a deadly territory that, I mean, that was shocking to me actually, going over from here. Made here just seem so provincial and safe. It's like, yeah, it's actually, you'd have to be extremely careful. Like, you could easily lose your life in those type of wild spaces, whereas here, you're much more safe.
Yeah, I always think about when I was doing my forest school training, I did it in Scotland, and there were some Australians on the course. And the forest school trainer was like, okay, so like, if we're thinking about what risks, like, what might we need to think about? And all the British practitioners are like, probably like stinging nettle and, you know, and like, they get to Australians, they're like, yeah, okay, so spiders, snakes, like listing all this stuff. We're like, oh yeah, okay, we need to think about like context here, because it is important. There's, and that's something that has come up in my research, is talking about, I was talking about British autistic adults' perceptions of nature and thinking of nature as like a safe space to be in. And one of the reviewers on this paper came back and we're like, okay, but can you acknowledge that like this is very context specific? Because there is not, you can't say universally that like being outside or being in wild spaces or whatever is free of risk, because that is a very British perspective to be like, oh yeah, I can be out and actually like be out in the middle of the Highlands, and the thing I'm most worried about is other humans, which is, yeah, I was like, okay, yeah, I do need to kind of check again. That's like my own positionality, my own biases that have to be considered there.
Definitely. And I mean, my family comes from Ireland, where like there's the whole, I mean, rural Limerick, County Limerick. I spent a lot of my childhood there, and there was, the supernatural was involved in that so much, but in a way that was quite frightening sometimes. The banshee, and then like the fairies, and fairies we think of like here more as something really pleasant, and that they exist and sleep in rose petals and things like that, but they're really can be malevolent, and they have a greater power than humans do. And if you build your house in the wrong place, even now people think this, if you build your house in the wrong place, the fairies can do some real, like, proper physical harm to you. And that was very much, and still is, a part of the culture there, which I guess I overhear as well. In the past, it would have been much more just, you know, you can feel that in like forests and things like, oh, you know, before we were so connected and knew so much in a scientific point of view, like if you were in the forest and something spooky happened, you know, you might blame it on some kind of supernatural force, but we've kind of lost that here, I think. I find all that fascinating.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. I'm trying to think of like a clever way to come to an ending, because I know that we're going to run out of time, but I haven't got a clever ending. But yeah, it's been really lovely listening to you both. So yeah, just if anyone has any kind of last questions or things that you feel we've not quite covered yet, but you really want to bring up, like now's the moment.
I don't have anything other than just to say that I think initially I felt quite nervous to have a conversation with an artist, because it's just so far out of my depth. Not that you're not completely lovely, and we met before obviously, so I knew that, but just felt really like, oh gosh, what, not like what are we gonna have in common, but like how are we going to kind of find connections? Because what we do is so different. But I think actually, first of all, I feel like we could talk for hours. So there's that.
Same.
But I think there's so many things that feel like parallels, or so many things that have been really natural, for lack of a better really natural connections. So yeah, it's been lovely. It's been lovely to speak with you.
I actually felt the same, because I always feel like, oh god, I'm so like not academic, and I don't really think in that way. And they, yeah, obviously felt some nerves about speaking with you, and was just in awe of your research. So yeah, it's just been really fascinating to talk with you, though, and yeah, just so many connections, and like, yeah, again, could just talk with you for hours. It's really exciting, and actually I feel quite inspired to take this into what I do. So yeah, thank you, and thank you, Bean, for
oh, yeah, great. I just, now that you've both said something, I just wanted to say, yeah, it's a really interesting point of putting people from different areas into conversation. And the last thing you were talking about, Sam, about how you capture data and how difficult it is to capture data, or how there's such prescribed ways of catching data. Yeah, it just makes me think it's a really interesting way of potentially doing that. And I guess, yeah, I think that's something that I'm also quite fascinated in, is how these kind of artistic experiences and processes are perhaps like evidence, or can be like alternative ways of capturing data or thinking about scientific processes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yes, I will not open that up into a whole nother discussion. So. With that, thank you both so much for joining me, and yeah, maybe we can continue the conversation again another time.
That would be lovely.
Thanks to the excellent initiator of this project, Murmurations, and great curator Ali Bean, as well as staff at UCA, plus all the contributors, including Bean, Clay Beresford, Charlotte Proctor, Dan and Molly Clark, plus Hannah Silver, Karen McLennan, Rowanna Mitchell, Poppy Jackson, and Samantha Friedman. The music you heard on the guitar was composed by Clay Beresford. We had sound support from Oliver Pratt, and this has been edited kindly by Dan Watts. Final thank you to the Woodland team at Tribal Animals, who made our trips flow with such ease. Thanks to them. If you got to the end of listening to this podcast, why don't you go down into the woods?
Audio warbles. Audio warbles. Audio warbles. Audio warbles.
Audio warbles.
Audio warbles.
Audio warbles.